You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Fiona Barton.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories, the podcast where we bring you the story behind the stories and the storyteller. Author interviews, writing advice, book reviews, all sorts of great stuff. If you are a book lover, Author Stories is the place for you. We have more than 550 author interviews in our archives at HankGarner.com. Please go over there and check it out. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we also have all of the episodes archived there. If you don't find an author interview that you're looking for on the website, click on the Archives tab. There's a long list of them where you can click and download and listen right there. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors that make the show possible. Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal Pico Watanabe and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her new Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com, that's PicosHouse.com, for all your book publishing needs. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series book. Hundreds of years in Earth's future sees the United Global Territories striving to colonize the Moon and Mars. The discovery of a clean energy source ended the world's reliance on fossil fuels overnight, and years after the resulting wars, a new discovery puts the tenuous world peace at risk. That of faster-than-light travel. With humanity on the verge of traveling to new solar systems and all the humanitarian and scientific possibilities involved, a discovery by the reconnaissance team turns everything upside down. Join the small team of the reconnaissance mission who fight friend and foe to complete their mission objectives, no matter where it leads them or what the personal cost. Devin Ford, Recon, the Expansion Series, Book 1. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Fiona Barton on the show with me today. Fiona has a fantastic new book. It's out everywhere now called The Suspect, and this is going to be one of the best psychological suspense thrillers of the year. I can just feel it. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Well, thank you so much. What a lovely intro.
Well, thanks. Fiona, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Ooh.
Provocative,
well,
huh?
I learned to read, and I was a real bookworm. And so I suppose I became kind of infected by that desire to be all about stories very early on. It was reading a book about four children on an adventure during the summer holidays called Swallows and Amazons. That really kind of pulled me into its world. And I went on my parents drove us to Italy that summer, and I don't remember a single thing about it. They kept saying, look at this mountain. And I'd be in the book, still in the Lake District. So that was really what fired my imagination, and I'm a passionate reader. I read every day. I can't imagine a day without reading, really.
Love that. Did adventure stories, did they always capture your imagination? Have you been a lover of adventure and kind of high-stakes fiction?
Sort of. But it was the characters in the book that I loved. I wanted to be all of them. And so that's what really pulled me in. And then as I got older, my mum was a big Agatha Christie fan. So I started in on the murder mysteries, and I loved that, you know, the sort of the the guessing games that went on, the not knowing really what people were like. And so I quickly sort of moved on to that sort of psychological thriller, really. And that's what attracts me. I mean, I read very widely. You know, I read all sorts of books, love all sorts of books. But I do like a good character.
And once again, with Agatha Christie, the seeds were sown.
Yes, I guess so, yeah. I guess so.
Yeah.
And Sherlock Holmes, I read a lot of Sherlock Holmes. My dad was a reporter, and he worked from home. He worked for a daily newspaper, so I grew up in a newsroom, really. And so I was always fascinated by, you know, the stories that he was doing. He would be filing his copy on the phone while we were eating our beans on toast, you know, sort of murders and mayhem, crimes and whatever. So I wanted to be part of that. I thought that sounded a fantastic job to do, to know everything before anyone else.
Oh, right, right. Is that what ultimately motivated you to pursue writing as a career?
I guess so, yes. I mean, the journalism was definitely, you know, being immersed in it from a very early age. Although my brother and sister weren't interested at all, but I wanted to be a reporter very much from quite a young age. And that was enough for me, really. I had my reading, I had my books, I loved them, and I was writing every day. So there wasn't part of me saying, you know, come on, I've got to get on and write a novel. I was happy doing what I was doing, and it was very full time. So it was only when I stopped being a reporter and stopped writing that I realized there was a real sort of gap in my life, I suppose. And I had time to do something about it. You know, the children were grown up, and I'd left reporting. We'd gone to Sri Lanka to, I was training journalists. So I had a bit of time and I had some ideas, and so I got on with it, finally.
Did your father recognize that you had sort of this keen interest to live the sort of life that he was living, or and did he give you any advice?
Yes, he said, don't do it. He did. He said, because, I mean, you know, my father's 87 in a couple of weeks. He came from a generation of reporters where women only wrote, you know, the features, the fluffy stories. And I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to do the news. And he said, oh, I don't think it's a good career for a woman. Oh, he would blush to hear me tell you this. But he did say that. And I think he was worried, because it was so competitive, he was worried that I would set my sights on it too early and not, you know, look around at other things. Anyway, I was single-minded, so I carried on, and he was very pleased when I got a job as a reporter, despite all that.
I'm sure he was. Yeah. I'm sure it was just the father's tendency to want to protect children.
Exactly, exactly.
Not subject you to the harshities of the world.
Well, quite, and it was a very, you know, testosterone-fueled world at that time. But actually, my generation coming through, there were equal numbers of women and men reporters, actually probably more women than men towards the end. But yeah, it was it wasn't as he thought it might be, where I'd be bullied or whatever.
Right. Do you feel like your time as a journalist has affected the way that you write fiction, or maybe the way you see stories?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I mean, 30 years of doing the job means that you can't unlearn everything. I've had to unlearn front loading, so I no longer tell my stories in the first paragraph. It's not great for a thriller. I've learned the drip, drip, drip. But I have kept the style, I suppose, because, you know, that's how I write. That's how I learned to write. Those seeds were sown a long time ago. So I write short, sharp, don't waste words, keep it tight, keep it moving. That's how I wrote news stories. So I've kept that. I don't think that's a bad thing in fiction, but I've had to write a lot more words. So I've had to allow myself to invent a bit. But I think I root everything that I write in experience, because I've been very lucky that I've had all those years of meeting incredible people, you know, boring people, incredible people, bad people, good people, funny people, sad people. So I've got a really great cast of characters to draw on.
Sure. I've met quite a number of former journalists who now write fiction, and a lot of you guys write crime fiction or thriller. That sort of story, the pulse pounding kind of unfolding tale, if you will. Do you feel like that your time as a reporter, as a journalist, helped you to see the world differently? And do you think that that is a skill that is beneficial to a fiction writer? I guess, you know, when you're reporting on a scene and maybe you show up and there are five other competing journalists there, you know, you need to see the scene differently than everyone else does so that your story stands out. Or that's the way it would seem to me. Is that true? And is that helpful?
I'm not sure differently. I know what you're getting at, and of course, you know, you're all there writing the same story, so you want an angle, you want something that others haven't got, you know, you want to do the job even better than them, you know, sometimes you do it, sometimes you don't, but yes, I think, and also it's instant, the training is to go and to take everything in at once, you know, sort of drink it all in, because you're going to need every bit of colour, every sound, smell, whatever, just to inform the writing, not necessarily to, you know, to say she was wearing a purple dress, but do you know what I mean? It was sort of, you paint a picture, you have a picture in your head that really you never let go of. And it's observational things, noticing things that will bring the story alive, will make it sing.
The Widow was your first book to be published, and it was a phenomenal success, probably a much bigger success than you ever imagined.
Yeah.
Was that the first novel that you wrote?
Yeah, goodness, yes. I mean, and it was surreal to have that success. I was working at the time in Myanmar, former Burma, helping set up a college of journalism. And I'd written The Widow over a number of years. I'd sort of stopped and started. And finally, I finished it, and I sent it to an agent, and she said, yep. And then while I was away, she was, you know, talking to publishers. And I would get emails overnight, because I was in a different time zone, saying it's been sold in Germany, it's been sold in the States. And it was like standing on a pavement watching a parade go by that had very little to do with me. It was really odd and thrilling and wonderful, but odd. it was an exciting time.
Incredible. A lot of people ask writers, you know, where do your ideas come from, or where'd the idea for this book come from? But, my experience is we're surrounded by ideas constantly. But there's something about the particular idea that rises to the top or seems more special than another, or more plausible, maybe. Mm. When you are trained to see the world and to pick apart things that might be interesting to people, as a journalist, how do you pick out that idea that's going to be the idea that carries a story all the way through?
It's back to reporting. They say you have a nose for news. It means that you see the angle of the story that's going to bring, you know, make people interested. So I guess there's that. But, you know, it's when I'm thinking about an idea, something will, you know, just beckon me to it, I think. It's it might just be a line. So with Jean in The Widow, it was the phrase, "No more of his nonsense." That kind of hooked me in, because it painted the sort of person she was, the dilemma she was facing, and how she was dealing with it. So it can just be as simple as that, or it can be an image in your head. For the child, it was the image of a baby being buried. And for the suspect, I wanted Kate to face the media as the story, and wanted to turn the tables on her. And so I needed something that would really matter to her, and matter to the reader. So I used my own terrible son. He was 18, and he went on a gap year to Vietnam. He's now almost 35 and a psychiatrist. But he was terrible at staying in touch. There was no social media to help me. I had to wait for postcards and letters or the occasional phone call. And I was convinced, over and over that something terrible had happened to him. So I did use that. I infected Kate and the mothers with that fear.
The idea of the gap year is not quite as popular or prominent here in the States as maybe in the UK. What is the idea behind the gap year, and why was it important to have that to be such an integral part of the story?
Well, the gap year, I wasn't sure how. Everybody I've spoken to in the States has said a different thing. So basically, gap year is when a teenager finishes high school, I suppose it is, at 18, and they want to go to university. They have a place at university often, but they want to take a year off in between to get some life experiences, to kick back a bit, to go and do something very structured. Tom, my son, went to teach English in Vietnam, and young people go to work with charities, they go and work in schools, so it's not just having a holiday. It is more about sort of maturing before they go away to university. But it's become this sort
because of asking an 18-year-old to make a decision for the rest of their lives is pretty daunting without any world experience.
Absolutely it is. And they go, if they want to do medicine or something, they go and do internships, they go and do, some work experience. I think it's very healthy. But it's become this sort of rite of passage, really. So that's why it was important for the book.
You had this personal experience with your son of knowing the fear and the kind of the constant dread. That's a natural tension builder, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. It's very wearing, I tell you. I was so glad when he came home.
Yeah. You said writing Kate in this book feels like coming home. Mm. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we don't share DNA, but we know each other very well. And so everywhere she goes, I've been. I have definitely rooted it in experience. The newsroom scenes, on the road, knocking on doors, interviewing people, feeling wobbly after an emotional interview, all of those things. I know. I'm not Kate. I mean, she is an amalgam of all the Kates I've ever worked with or met. So she's some of the worst, some of the best. But I feel so comfortable writing her because I know her.
Right. Is this the first time you've used a journalist as your kind of main protagonist of the story?
I've written three books, and she was not supposed to be a main protagonist at all, but she was there purely for the widow, Jean, to tell her story to, like I was as a reporter. She's there really just as a sort of a messenger, really. Anyway, she got in the door, and I enjoyed writing her so much, and she gave me freedom. If you have a detective, they've got to fill everything out in triplicate, and they have to have an evidential chain, and there's a lot of admin goes into it. Whereas with a journalist, you're much more nimble. You can dip into a story straight away. You're not, you know, having to do all that paperwork. You can go in, ask the same sort of questions that a detective would ask, and then write it. And it's done, and then you move on the next day. So it helped with the pace of things, I think.
Right. How did you go about researching this book? Your personal experience with your son, you said it was before social media, and that whole communication landscape has changed. So I would imagine some of that comes into the book. But what about researching, the place and the circumstances around the plot?
Well, I went to Bangkok for 4 days. I know the region well, but I'd never been outside the airport at Bangkok. I'd always been passing through. And I'd chosen it because it's such a hub for backpackers and gap year of all nationalities, all ages. It's the place to, it's a jumping off point, really. So I went for 4 days and I sat at the cafes and bars, listening, watching, fearing for them. And I found my hostel. I found the Paradise Bar. It isn't called that, obviously, but irony is very rich in Bangkok. All these appalling hovels are called things like, you know, the magnificent and the wonderful and the beautiful. But there we are. And the royal, lots of royal dumps. So I found the hostel. I found Mama doing exactly what she does in the book, sweeping up outside her bar. And it was great for me because I need to sniff the air. I just Google Maps doesn't do it for me.
Well, there are, Google Maps can do a lot, but like you said, you can't sniff the air.
No.
You can't get the flavor of the subtleties that you just can't see.
No, exactly. You know, who's watching who. And just sort of watching the dynamics of the young people just starting out and those that have been there a week are already, you know, sort of being a bit world weary. It was fascinating.
There's some kind of big ideas in the book that we wrestle with. One of those is the relationship with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, do we really know our children? Can we trust them like we think we did? And just because we have ideas that we have done our job as parents, does that necessarily translate? What are some of the big things that we're wrestling with in this book? And what can you say to us as parents about that?
Well, I suppose, I mean, at the core of it is that we can never know anybody completely. I looked at this a bit in The Widow with Jean and Glenn, her husband. You know, can you really know completely the person that you have chosen to spend the rest of your life with? With a child, it's even more complicated because they are of you and you are their main influence. You are the person who's supposed to guide them as they grow. So, and I think the answer is no, of course you can't know your child completely. They're a human being. They're complex. They have secrets. We all have secrets. Nobody is completely the person they put themselves out there as. So I use the social media element of the story really to point that up, that disconnect between the person we say we are, you know, the person living the dream on Facebook and having a wonderful time in Bangkok, and the reality of the struggles, the disasters, the things going wrong in real life, what we hide when we put things like that on Facebook.
As having such success with your first novel, and you know, I talk a lot about the gift of anonymity when you're when you're writing that first book, that no
wonderful.
One knows that you're writing it, and there's no pressure. It's just you and the story and the characters, and you're just having a grand time. And then the story goes out to the world, and then people know about it, and then people start buying it, and you wind up on the, on the Times, bestseller list. Yeah. And then all of a sudden everyone wants more from you. And then book two and book three. What sort of adjustment is that coming off of such a raging success? And then, finding your creativity again amidst the storm of, all the things that come with being a writer that have nothing to do with writing.
It's hideous. That's what it is. And I think any author you talk to, well, actually, some people have already written their second when their first is published. But no, I mean, it was alarming. I was panic stricken. As you said, it was lovely. I was in my little bubble, writing The Widow. Nobody knew, nobody cared. Of course, you're beset with self-doubt, thinking, oh, this is rubbish, nobody will want to see it. But second book, expectations are there, and there's a deadline from the first word. So it was really scary, and I panicked and just, set off without having had that cooking time, if you like, that I had with the first. So I rewrote the second half of The Child. I thought I knew what the ending was, but I didn't. And my wonderful editors said to me, there was a bit of a ghastly silence, but when I delivered the first draft, but they came back and they said they knew I wasn't happy with it. And they said, well, would you like a bit more time? And I said, yes, please. So what I learned was that thinking is writing, not just putting your fingers on the keyboard. So I factor in a lot more staring at the wall, going on long walks, letting things play before I start writing them. So I'm writing in my head much more than I did with the second one, and that's really worked much better for me. Not to say the third one was easy, but it wasn't. They're all a mountain to climb.
Well, it's so important, isn't it? We think of writing as sitting down and getting a daily word count, and sometimes it's just giving yourself the space to allow the story to grow.
It's absolutely that, because I think if you sort of yoke yourself to a word count, you are setting yourself up for failure, but it makes it more difficult, because you've got to rewrite those words when you've thought about them and think, well, actually, no, she wouldn't have done that. Perhaps she'd have done that, or he could have done it. You know what I mean? So you're writing before you've finished the thought, and I like to do it the other way around.
I like that. The Suspect is out everywhere now. Fiona, if people are just learning about you and want to learn more about your work and dig into your back catalog and all of that good stuff, is there a place online where they can connect with you?
I've got a webpage. I've got FionaBartonAuthor.com, but I'm also on Facebook, FionaBartonAuthor.com. Not much imagination went in there. And on Twitter, at Fig Barton, F-I-G, like the fruit, Barton.
Excellent. Fiona, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy of the new book. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
The Locus, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The Complete Locus series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas, where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers must do what it takes to survive. The three books, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Atlantica arrives in a strange new world, unable to locate land and with no way to contact home. They must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locus. The Locus box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science book. Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today from Ralph Kern, The Locus. The Renegade Star Series, books 1-3 from J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. so long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900 plus pages, 300 plus five-star reviews. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns the series takes, or the secrets that get them. The Renegade Star series, get the entire box set on Amazon, or audiobook from audible.com. There's links to it in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Find all the archives at hankgarner.com. Now, stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleeb's The Jason Crane Series.
Mather steepled his hands. You asked to join us once. Hedwig leaned forward, eagerly. The appointed. Does that appeal?
Yes.
Do you even know what we do?
My grandmother used to say that you control the world.
That's not far off. But why? To what end?
I don't know. Power?
Pour me a bourbon.
Mather reached into his briefcase and produced a file folder. I want to tell you one story.
Have you ever heard of Centralia, Pennsylvania?
No.
He produced a photo for Hedwig's inspection.
Spring of 1962. A pretty little town, wasn't it? Whitewash and ticky-tacky. Pastel housewives and perfect lawns. A mining community, mostly. Coal.
He turned over a second photo. A lovely young woman.
There was a single witch in Centralia named Anna Lively.
Anna had a green thumb. She could make her garden grow, whisper to a flower, and send it shooting from the ground like that. Just lovely. But she was discovered. That spring, a boy named Bobby Avery received a Bell and Howell Zoomatic movie camera for his 11th birthday. Bobby amused himself by filming his neighbors, sometimes without their knowledge, through windows and over garden fences. 12 seconds of film. Just a girl and her garden patch and one swiftly blooming rose. It killed the town. Bobby showed it to his friends. Children believe readily. Bobby was the first to die. Parents looked into it, watched the film themselves, and they began to die. Anna disappeared. Perhaps they attacked her, perhaps she escaped. But even in her absence, knowledge of a true witch was running wild through the population, as if Anna had beckoned it herself to grow verdant and spread.
The great curse had killed 64 Centralians by the 1st of June.
The footage was offered to a national news organization. That was the precipice. It might have been shown in prime time, between Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons. We came very close to another worldwide calamity, but we were fortunate. One of our own was in place at the network. He alerted his superiors, and they ended the situation. Do you know how?
I'm afraid to ask.
Mather laid down another photo.
This is Centralia
today. It was an aerial view of a forest. Endless trees and underbrush cut through by lanes of pavement. Just a maze of cracking asphalt, like the foundations of Sodom, ripped bare by the wrath of God. Only a cemetery remained, on a hill overlooking the former town. A white marble angel stood among the graves, grieving for the ruins below, like Lot's wife, turned to salt.
You destroyed the whole town?
Not I. This was well before my time. But, yes. Just as you'd cauterize a wound to stop a patient from bleeding to death. We blamed it on an uncontrollable mine fire deep below the earth. We actually set the coal burning in case someone investigated. It burns today. Touch any of those streets and you'll find them hot, the asphalt melting as if the town sat just above perdition. It's not something we're proud of, but it was necessary to save the world. Centralia, Pennsylvania, and everyone who'd seen that film had to be sacrificed.
Mather collected the photos. So, that is why the appointed exist, and that is what we do. Still want to join